Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009 when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on, not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
Welcome live to a late night edition of Carson's Corner, Monday, 11 p.m., October 6, 2014. My name is Bob Carson. Pleased to be with you here tonight. We have the chat room open. We also have the phones if you want to give me a call, 347-326-9749, 347-326-9749. And I just had to get this show out of my system because we've been doing so much work with the election boycott advocates, and the last three or four editions of this show have just been all election boycott advocates. We had various different discussions with various different guests about the topic of boycotting elections, and what happens is that the discussions get so passionate, and there's so many people involved is that my job, really, you know, of course I offer my input, but my job mainly becomes that of a moderator, just, you know, letting people know when they could speak and trying to, you know, divide the time equally. And I've gotten away from commentary, which is why I want to do the show. This show is sort of good for me. It's going to be therapeutic for me because it allows me to go back to what I've been doing all along, which is just give you commentary on many different subjects virtually uninterrupted and off the cuff. And that's what we do here on Carson's Corner. I don't believe in doing scripted radio. I believe that many of the so-called progressive podcasts and shows that you see, even the so-called professional, what do they call it, the professional left, we don't like using labels. We try to avoid that on this show, are scripted. And that's the problem. I mean, you look at some of these people out there, and I don't want to mention names, but it's boring. It doesn't make for good radio. It doesn't make for good television. Okay, and as much as I criticize the fascists over at Fox News, I love criticizing Fox News. It's very, very easy. In fact, it's somewhat intellectually lazy to go after Fox News because I think that Fox News is just so clearly defined that but they have good personalities there. You know, there's not a person on that network, at least in the prime time lineup, that doesn't have a degree of talent and doesn't know how to do a good television show and have a personality and whatnot. And you look at the lineup on MSNBC, which I don't watch. I've stopped watching MSNBC. I don't own a television. I haven't owned a television since 2008. I'm very proud of that fact, folks. We reject the corporate media here on Carson's Corner. We reject the 1% punditocracy, whatever you want to call them. These individuals that did not grow up they did not start from the ground up. We reject these individuals. MSNBC thinks that they could put someone on like Chris Hayes, or think they could put someone on like Rachel Maddow, and somehow that's going to carry an audience. That's just going to make people tune in. And you look at the ratings on these programs, and they're just a disaster. They're declining, and there's no comparison between Fox News and MSNBC because Fox News is carried in more households, as I understand it. It's on free TV. So you go to every truck stop, every restaurant, so you've got Fox News on there. And MSNBC, you have to pay to get MSNBC. So they're in less households. But nonetheless, it's terrible programming. And, you know, they just – the faces on MSNBC really is what the establishment puts out there to be the new face of the, quote, Democratic Party. And it's really unfortunate because – MSNBC is wired into the Obama administration. MSNBC, which is owned by the parent company, NBC News, which I believe is owned by General Electric, which we know Jeffrey Immelt is Obama's economic advisor. And you know, there's just a whole host of connections that make it invalid to me and many others. And I think that's part of the reason why their lineup, their ratings are just plummeting, just ridiculous. It's plummeting. And so that's what we try to do here. And also, you know, politicians use teleprompters as well. There's no such thing as off-the-cuff speaking in public anymore, it seems like. You know, everybody's got an image maker. Everybody's got a brand maker, right? They've got somebody to poll tested comments and poll tested this and that, and it's just worse with politicians. I mean, Ronald Reagan famously spoke in front of four or five teleprompters, so he would position four or five teleprompters over the audience and move his head, you know, facing each teleprompter, giving the appearance that he's talking to, he's looking at everybody in the crowd. And President Obama is the same way, really. And so this creates a distrust among the American people and politicians, and it's one of the reasons why we don't do it here on Carson's Corner. It's a no-frills, independent, progressive podcast that really is not market-approved. And that's a key thing here, folks, okay? Carson's Corner is not a market-approved podcast, neither is the election boycott advocates. It's not a market-approved movement. But we're not a market-approved podcast in just about every way. And so as a result of that, we have an uphill battle ahead of us. We will always have an uphill climb because we do not want to make it in the filter or the corporate filtering system. Okay, those that are market approved, we know that the market is flawed. We know that the market is inefficient. The market has no principles. Okay, and so those that you see on television, those that you hear on corporate owned and corporate sponsored radio, are market approved, and you've got to keep that in mind. But we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about a lot here today on Carson's Corner, as always. I want to talk about some of the issues facing the working class. Okay, it's almost dangerous to say that in the public arena. I mean, you could say that on venues such as this, but once you start to say that on the corporate media, you get a lot of blowback for that. But we have so many issues that are facing the working class that, unfortunately, because of our corporate media structure, because of our politicians, because of money being paramount to everything, this doesn't get a full discussion. We don't get a full analysis of the issues facing working Americans, okay, working class people, individuals like myself. I would categorize myself as a working poor individual. I have no money, okay? Right now I'm living with a relative, as I have off and on for the past, three or four years, actually for the past 4 years. Only two times I've lived with a relative. But it's due to debt. It's due to, a lack of mobility. It's due to a lack of a decent job. And I got to tell you, I'm going to digress here for a little bit, but I want to get back to the issues facing the working class here. The more I see how corrupt our system is, and the more I see how people get ahead in this capitalist system, the more and more opposed to the system, the more and more, angry and committed to withdrawing myself from the system I get. And I think that I speak for a lot of people, particularly in the Occupy movement or the Occupy movement, as Paul Street says, individuals that are disenfranchised, individuals that are, because of the economic system, because of the new normals of capitalism, are just in a state of constant decline, where nowadays the new American dream is to get out of debt. I mean, forget about owning a home. Forget about having a decent job. Forgetting about putting your kids through college. The American dream now is to get out of debt. And the more I see this, the more I just become more committed, almost more radicalized in my beliefs. And, capitalism and the politicians that exist to serve the capitalist, the ruling class, however you want to refer to them, the ownership class, the ruling class, the bourgeoisie, fill in the blank. Those that are well adjusted to a sick game have to use their connections. They have to brown nose. They have to barter with people. They have to play the political game. They have to almost sell out their integrity in an effort to get ahead, an effort to get a promotion, in an effort to get a raise or whatever. At my job, I'm a wage slave, okay? I have to rent myself out for employment, and I'm not going to tell you where I do it, but needless to say that the organization I work for conflicts dearly with my political beliefs and this show, but we justify that because you have to rent yourself out for survival in the capitalist system. You have to do what you have to do to the person that's going to pay you the most under our market system, right? And what I see in this organization is those that play the game, unfortunately, those that have very little substance. Those that do not go outside of work and those that do not, you know, engage in brown nosing and try to have, you know, relationships with people outside of work never get the promotions. And I don't like to make anecdotal arguments on this program, but I got to tell you, I think this, I'm going to relate it back to, you know, our political system. That's what we have right now, where, you know, people like myself who don't play the game, who believe that politics, although maybe necessary in the organization, playing politics should not factor into whether or not someone gets a promotion or whether or not somebody gets ahead in the organization. But it does, because this is the system. People are promoted on the basis of looks. Okay, I'm talking about my organization, but I think this is true in general in America, you know, where if you look a certain way, if you're a cardboard cutout, if you're someone who looks like an Abercrombie model, you're going to get the promotion. And I'm seeing this in my line of work every single day, and it's absolutely disgusting. It makes me sick because these are the wrong reasons that people should be promoted in our system. But you know what? These reasons are reinforced when you look at who's on television. When you look at, you know, I mentioned before the pundit class, right? These people are on television. Actors become actors. Actresses become actresses. CEOs become CEOs in large part due to their looks. Not for, you know, their substance, not for the knowledge that they've acquired. It's all about their looks. And that is what, you know, our economic system has come to represent here, where, you know, companies and politicians are only concerned about image, public image. Looks are really a superficial measure, but that is, you know, very, very important in our society, in our market-based system. And all the while, you know, substantive people, individuals that have knowledge, they cannot make it through the corporate filtering system. And it's wrong. It really is. But we would expect no different in our capitalist system, because it's the 1%. It's the ruling class that owns the media. They own the culture. So the next time you hear somebody talk about the culture of poverty or the gangster rap culture or, you know, any one of these terms, right, ask them, well, who owns the culture? Who owns the media? Which class owns everything? Well, it's the ruling class. And you look at politicians in this system right now. Politicians are the worst among us. Politicians are the ones that take brown nosing and take politics, takes, you know, making deals and bartering and this and that to the highest extent. These people are masters of the game. Okay, that's why half of Congress are millionaires, right? You know, you've got a small percentage of the population that are millionaires, and yet over 50% of Congress are millionaires, and that's going to keep on growing and growing and growing as we continue, you know, in this corrupt game. Look at President Obama, a perfect example of someone who, you know, used political connections, you know, smoothed his way up to, you know, with the business community. Okay, and now, you know, President Obama became a junior senator in Illinois, and then he became the president of the United States. These people represent the worst of us. They are well adjusted to a sick game in a sick society, and you know, I'm just so fed up with it. You see this everywhere. It's every single where in this country. And right now in America, people are too inundated with sports. I made a mistake last night on this show when I misquoted Karl Marx, when saying that Karl Marx said that sports are essentially opium for the masses. Well, you know what? He was talking about religion. But you can talk about sports as well. What's the difference? You know, sports are opium for the masses, and people are too inundated with sports, college football, NFL football, this game, that game, that sport. And at the end of the day, these issues are flying by the American people, and nobody's giving a proper analysis of our system, which is why we are continuing along the same trajectory we have been for the past 30-plus years, and it's killing us. It is robbing us of our future, all right? And so, you know, this translates easy enough into our economy and how we have so many bubbles in our economy. Let me tell you, one of the foundations of bubbles in our economy, and Christopher Alan Driscoll, who was Ralph Nader's media director for Ralph Nader's three presidential campaigns. He's an election boycott advocate, and he co-hosts the show with me on Sunday. Christopher Alan Driscoll, I love having him on the program because he speaks so well. He's such a commanding presence on the air that, you know, we love to hear from him. And I go back after every show that we have from the election boycott advocates, I go back and I write down what we talk about because it's all very important. But I think that we need to go, you know, at least from my perspective and my commentary, I think we need to go into specifics because I think oftentimes, you know, we talk about how corrupt the system is and, you know, billionaires and plutocrats and all that stuff. And we need to examine some of the particulars that – you know, are going on in our economy so people have a better understanding. And when we talk about bubbles, Christopher Alan Driscoll mentioned on this program on, I think it was September 28th, that our economy is filled with so many different bubbles that it's almost unbearable for the American public. The American public cannot understand just how fake our economy is, just how, you know, our economy nowadays is not built on anything tangible. You see, we used to have a manufacturing sector in the United States of America where you had, you know, a quarter, if not a third, of all manufacturing jobs and jobs in America were manufacturing. You had, you know, areas of the country like Detroit, you know, other areas which just had, you know, many manufacturing jobs. We produce things, you know, we produced, you know, I can go over the statistics. We were the number one exporter of, you know, finished goods. Okay. We led the world. Many industries were built really after World War II, when we had a high rate of unionization, and it was tangible. It was all tangible. And now, because it's like you know, they say, if you take a piece of iron ore, Tom Hartman says this, if you take a piece of iron ore, you make a car door, you create wealth. Wealth is created, true wealth is created by making things, okay, by building things that last for a long time, that are tangible, that are real, that you could put your hands on, okay? But what we've had over the last 30-plus years, and we saw this in the lead-up to the Great Depression, is the financialization of our economy. And this is spurred on in large part by low taxes on the very wealthy. Okay, when Ronald Reagan came in, the top tax rate was 70% on the very wealthy. Okay, and this was historically low because during the FDR days, FDR raised it to, what, 90%, 92%, okay? He welcomed the hate of the ruling elites. We saw in, was it 1934, the business plot, where the various business interests, elitists, the ruling class, they tried to physically, using a bunch of fascist veterans, they tried to physically overthrow Franklin Delano Roosevelt. All right, you know, you can read more about this online, but yeah, the business plot was very real. It's what happened to FDR when FDR tried to, you know, change things, when people credit him as saving capitalism, whatever. It doesn't make a difference. But he raised taxes on the very wealthy. There was a tax on Wall Street transactions, which stabilized the national debt and stabilized the deficit each year. All of this basically put an end to bubbles in America. I mean, you didn't have the volatile economy that we have now, okay? We also had great regulation that went to regulating Wall Street after the Great Depression, because the American public understood that Wall Street is dangerous, okay? Wall Street can wreck everything, and Wall Street is, you know, trading what Peter Joseph would call these toxic, fraudulent derivatives that have real no value. Money for the pursuit of money, the narrow self-interested pursuit of money, which the term money, you can argue, is not even real, because these are nothing but loan contracts traded. And so all of this was basically nullified by good regulation, and regulation is necessary. Regulation is what creates the rules. Regulation is law and order. But then in 1980, with Ronald Reagan, something happened in this country. And Reagan really inflicted a true revolution on the American people. He was building on what Thatcher did in 1978. Okay, and Reagan, one of the first things he did while in office, I think it was 1981, he instituted his tax cut. Now, this was devastating because, as we know, whenever you cut taxes on the very wealthy, a whole host of negative activities occur in the economy. It is inevitable because the rich have all this extra money, and what the rich do with their extra money is they use it to make more money, and money equals power in our society. He who has the gold rules, and everybody else basically has to suffer. And this is what has happened since 1980, is ever since Ronald Reagan cut taxes on the very wealthy, he tripled the national debt in doing so. We had a revolution in terms of manufacturing. Reagan fired the Patco workers, okay? We had the political financialization of our economy occurred under Ronald Reagan. You could go back to what 1982 and 1983, where Reagan deregulated the SNLs, and this all culminated in a volatile economy characterized by booms and busts. Okay, Reagan was the first person that started us on the path that we are today, and you know, during the Reagan years, It was common for someone that worked in an investment bank to have two jobs. Okay, there was a good documentary called Inside Job by Charles Ferguson, in which he talks about he interviews a guy who one of the people in the film talks about a guy who, you know, worked for Morgan Stanley and had two jobs. But after they deregulated the SNLs and after the 1981 Reagan tax cut, and, you know, a real political revolution, stealth wealth in America. You know, greed is good. I got my million, get yours. This you know, selfish, we are not a we society. We built it society. The same, you know, sort of message that we hear right now from the ruling class. This guy became a millionaire, didn't have to work, under the Reagan administration. And then it was off to the races from there. And so, you know, everything, because finance has taken over. And, you know, one concept that I'm studying now, but it's worth mentioning, and I'm not going to pretend like, you know, I'd have a full grasp on it, but I think I have a gist of understanding of it. It's something that David Harvey talks about, fictitious capital, where basically the lenders of money, the banks, the creators of money, the Federal Reserve, okay, which loans money to our government and whatnot, they're loaning money, you money to buy a house, right? And then they're loaning the bank money as well that finances you. You know, they're basically running everything, and so this is what happens right now, where you know finance has taken over everything. Finance has taken over factories right now. We have fictitious capital running amok. And now, because of this, there are all these bubbles in our economy that are just absolutely waiting to bust. We have not changed the fundamentals of our economy. And so now, you know, everything is basically a mirage. Everything, that there's nothing tangible right now. And as David Harvey points out, fictitious capital now is more significant than the actual system. It's just unbelievable, okay? But, you know, the financial institutions, the bubbles in our economy that will inevitably bust again, the student loan bubble. Another example. I am a perfect example of this. Let me give you, you know what I did today, ladies and gentlemen? I had my day off today, right? And you know, after finishing a school paper, you know what I did? I had to go to the student loan website, okay? And I had to print out all my student loans because I'm trying to get a loan right now to pay off my credit card debt and to pay off some other debt so I could get out of living with my relative and you know try to get out on my own, okay? Feel better about myself in that regard, all right? And so I had to print out all my student loans, right? And I as a way to try to qualify for a new loan. And I have almost six figures in student loan debt, okay? Six figures in student loan debt. We have student loan debt in the United States now that supersedes credit card debt, okay? And as a result of all of the student loan debt in a job market that is deliberately crafted to make sure that there are more seekers than actual jobs, which puts a downward pressure on wages right now. In a job market that is characterized by the negative activities that we spoke about earlier, offshoring, a corporate tax code designed to incentivize corporations to ship jobs overseas, a ruling class comprised of stockholders, bondholders that have no attachment whatsoever to the company workforce. We have, just fill in the blank, a tax code that is written for and by groups like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. All of this is going to require students like myself to do what I am doing right now. I told you about at the beginning of the show, submit to employment. Submit to employment, rent yourself out for survival to whoever will pay you the most, okay, for the jobs that are available out there. And this, unfortunately, is going to lead to students not being able to pay back the student loans that they've acquired. Now, in Germany, from my understanding, that they have just got rid of all student loan debt. In Germany, if you want to go to college, you can go to college for free. We used to do that here in the United States. But somewhere right around the time of Ronald Reagan, the government started to pick up less and less and less of the state and federal tuition. And now that void has been filled by the private banks, these same banks I'm talking about, the fictitious capital, right? The fictitious capital that has become more significant than the system itself, where you have now trillions of dollars of student loan debt, students not being able to pay their debt. What's going to happen to that? Well, inevitably, it's going to bust. It is going to bust because the students are not going to be able to pay up the debt. And these banks conveniently get their money from the Federal Reserve at a zero interest rate. They turn around and they charge individuals like me 6-7% All right, these banks are backstopped by the government. Many loans are administered by the government now, but still, it's this for-profit model. It's this you know run wild mentality that makes us have a bust now, or makes us the economy have another bubble, which will inevitably bust. You can look at any area in our economy now. You can look at credit card debt. Okay, again, debt has replaced paychecks in America. All right, the fundamentals of the economy have not been changed, so we're continuing along the same trajectory. And what happens if people file bankruptcy, or when you know people can't pay the interest rate on their credit cards, they go into bankruptcy. You know, just even the rent. You know, rent now. I think that's Laura Gotzendiener, who wrote a great article about how rent now is the new bubble. Rent is being basically, you know, put as a commodity and sold in sort of a securitization chain, which will inevitably bust. I mean, this is what caused the 2008 collapse, the securitization change, the packaging of loans. All types of loans and the selling it, of those loans to the investment bankers and you know putting people in risky subprime mortgages and an appraisal realm fraud and you know a liar loans epidemic, and you could just go on and on and on. But the point is, ladies and gentlemen, as you could see, is that bubbles in our economy are bound to bust. And when they do bust, you and I ultimately will have to pay for it, unless we have radical change in America. You know, I spoke about this yesterday on this show, where we had Jeff Howard, who's a longtime friend of the program. We had Thomas Baldwin and Christopher Allen Driscoll. When the material conditions of capitalism get to the point where where we have a meltdown, and the American people want answers, and they want things fixed, they will search for radical change. We saw this, you know, in 1929 with the Great Depression. You know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a moderate. He ran on deficit reduction. But eventually it got to the point where the American people understood what had happened, and they wanted to punish the very wealthy. They wanted to punish the rich, and the rich understood that in order for the economy to, you know, get back, in order for us not to move towards fascism, they're going to have to take a back seat to two things the wealthy hate among many: taxes and unionization. And the FDR New Deal programs spurred the post-World War II economic boom. You know, you had the Wagner Act, you had the GI Bill, you had all these government programs that prove that, you know, we can create a stable system, at least, you know, a stable compared to what we have now. I don't like it because Michael Moore refers to this as the old capitalism, and I think the problem is capitalism itself. But nonetheless, those are much different times in America. You did not have the levels of income inequality that are part of the new normal right now that we have in this country, okay? And these are the issues facing the working class. This is what inspires me to do this podcast, because let me tell you something, folks. Let me tell you something right now, all right? When, you know, I think it was Lenin, when he recruited for the Bolshevik Revolution, okay, and others would be, you know, more of an authority on the Russian Revolution. I'm still studying it, but one of the things that was actually mentioned in a book that I just stopped reading because I really couldn't take it, it's no disrespect to Leonard Zeskin, but there's a book called Blood and Politics, and I was reading it, and one of the points that he makes in the book is that when Lenin recruited, he recruited those that were most angry at the Tsar, and he recruited those that were the most affected by the system, the most radical, okay? And he turned those people into soldiers. Well, what we have now in capitalism, and the only way we're going to really change capitalism and perhaps maybe abolish it, I don't know. I don't have the answer to that, is through people like me, through people like the people that showed up in the Occupy protests, people that have felt the full weight of capitalism, people that have felt the full weight of the business community and have nothing to show for anything, cannot define themselves by playing a sick game, cannot define themselves by their employment when employment is centered around scarcity, okay? These are the people that are going to lead the change. And, you know, I see it with the younger generation out there. I see it with individuals that, you know, have a favorable opinion of socialism, that are not so, anti this and anti that. They're not afraid of the isms. Not that any of the isms are going to be our economic salvation, but in any event, that's where it's going to come from, because the country is changing demographically. Okay, the white grievance crowd that typically supports the Republicans, 90% of Republican representation in elections are from white people. 98% of the representation in Congress is white on the Republican side. And these people are dying off. They're not going to represent the American population going forward. Hopefully, at least demographically. Although, as Ian Haney Lopez points out, the Hispanic population, more and more Hispanics are identifying themselves as white. That's a whole other discussion. But still, you sort of can understand, where I'm going here is that it's going to come from people like us. It's going to come from people out there on the streets. And Harry Kaysen of the Zeitgeist Movement said, we need a social movement to do this. We can't work. He didn't say this, but he said, we need a social movement to, combat the negative activity spurred by capitalism. It's not going to be with inside the system. It's not going to be from, a politician who's elected to change things. It's not going to be, from, a media pundit. It's going to be from a group of people, a mass movement of people that'll organize around the money that is organized around all of us. And so, we're going to have to see what happens here, okay? Because these are the issues that face the working class. And I think that at this point, another byproduct of my disillusionment is I become more and more class conscious as I continue to just struggle. I just become more and more in line with the issues that the working class face in America. For example, a lack of upwards mobility. In the United States of America, the number one determining factor of where you will be when you're an adult is the socioeconomic status of your parents. This is a analysis that you will not hear in the corporate media for obvious reasons, because nobody in the corporate media started from the ground up. Nobody on television, nobody that's in the 1% virtually. There's always an exception to the rule, but for the most part, started from the ground up. I mean, if you're born poor, if you're born in the bottom of the economic ladder, you have a 1% chance of getting to the top. Okay, you have needs that are not addressed. All right, you take a rich kid, take a rich person, take anybody, and you show them a name, show them 100 people's last names, and you'll see that these people, by virtue of the family they're born into, by virtue of inheritance, and inheritance doesn't always apply just to a person's house or money or whatever. Inheritance applies to the legacy that your family inherits, the contacts, the institutions that your family really has collected over the years through being a one percenter, through being the person that I discussed earlier, the brown noser, the master of politics, the barterer, the person who's playing the game, working the system. Do me a favor, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. Yeah. This has become the very fabric of our system, and this is what you have to do, unfortunately, to have any measure, quote, of success in our disgusting system, which I just don't want to be a part of. Okay, well, these people, these kids know probably 80-90% of people on that list by virtue of the fact that they were born into favorable social circumstances. Okay, if these kids were born in a poor country, a Latin America country, a South America country, they would never be rich, but they're born, it's the lucky sperm club, as Tom Hartman. These are issues. This is just one of the issues facing the working class. When you realize that there's a lack of mobility in America, when you realize that we have been sold a self-made myth that if you work hard in America, you can succeed. No, that's not the case. The elites, the ruling class in America, take the exception and they make that into the rule. They take the exception, and that always constitutes the rule in the corporate media. They do this with poor people every day. I mean, how many times have you seen stories about the stereotypical welfare queen, drinking soda and doesn't want to work? Today I was on Facebook, and there was this article about a guy in Oklahoma berating somebody for panhandling and then going and driving a new car. You see stories like this all the time, right? Oh, the poor person who, actually when he was done panhandling, he gets into a BMW. You see stories like this all the time. And what this has done, it's part of a carefully crafted campaign of propaganda designed to minimize poverty in America. It's designed to get you to not focus on why people are poor, not focus on the system of capitalism that necessitates poverty. Focus on the individual. Focus on the one person that is claiming poverty and driving a new car. It minimizes it, and this is what our corporate media is comprised of. It's always the exception constitutes the rule, but. No, you could predict someone's SAT scores by the zip code they have. You could predict someone's socioeconomic. You could predict someone's income later on in life, just like you could predict someone's height based on their parents' height. It's disgusting, and it's an indictment on our system. It's an indictment. And once you realize this, once you look at empirical data, and empirical data is making the notion that the United States of America is the land of the free, home of the brave, laughable. It's just making it laughable. Okay? Once you realize this, you start to look at class in a different way. You start to look at the system in a different way. You start to look at people in a different way. Okay? And it's a whole other ball game. It's a whole other can of worms. We need to practice class solidarity. Okay, we need to say that corporate America and the very wealthy have their own ideological imperatives. As Ralph Nader says, they want the most feasible control of outcomes using the government, which consists of both political parties, as tools of enforcement. That's what our government has become, tools of enforcement for the rich. You and I are, we have our own ideological imperatives. We have our own a framework that we have that is going to make us more stable, That includes unionization. That includes bringing democracy to the workplace. That includes moving beyond capitalism, which is you could characterize as an economic system where most of the means of production and distribution are privatized. Moving beyond that, worker cooperatives, Gar Alperovitz, others that have really sought to move beyond capitalism. These are some of the issues facing the working class. High taxation on the very wealthy. This is a very much a working class issue because the tax base in America has shifted to punish us. You don't get to tell the government when you pay taxes. You don't get to tell the government where you pay taxes. The government deducts taxes out of your paycheck, and the government has become more reliable on the payroll tax than anything else. And most of the payroll taxes in America are paid for by poor schlubs like myself. Okay? This is a class issue. This is a working class issue here. Because, again, the wealthy do not pay taxes in America. The wealthy have experienced all of the income growth. They write our tax code. They have been for the past 30-plus years. Corporations pay next to nothing in taxes. The very wealthy have a variety of loopholes and allowable deductions. And as Ralph Nader points out, corporate welfare is more varied. It's more bipartisan than anything. Corporations consider a part of their business model. Not paying taxes in America, boosts their profits. It's become the new normal. And you know what? President Obama is in line with Mitt Romney and anybody else on corporate taxes. Okay? And what happens? You and I have to pay more. You and I have to, we have to kick 70,000 kids off of Head Start. We have to means test Medicare. We have to change the CPI, the rate of inflation adjustment on Social Security. We have to do all of that to, quote, balance the budget, right, to cut spending. We have such a spending problem. It's just it's disgusting. It's structural adjustment. And it's what's been happening in this country now for 30-plus years. And it's getting worse. All right, we're going to take a brief time out. I'm going to come back. And I want to tell you, I got an upcoming project here with I'm going to release this to Paul. I don't care. I think it's important. Harry Kaysen of the Zeitgeist Movement and I are going to be doing something. I'm going to tell you about it at the other end of this break, folks. So keep it right here on Carson's Corner.
I got no soul. Life in prison, no parole, no control. Hood, I got my number on a wiretap. Cause I jacked for Similac. Fuck a Cadillac, so fine. One motive, no focus. Every sidewalk, I'm off, it's like a tightrope. Yes, I know my deadline, sire. With my life in fire, I'm sending the resentment of the barbed wire. The mother of my genre, who's a mind at my grave. It's my life for that life, so call it a free trade. Well, neither am I even born a star. I took a death trip when I tried to cross.
Back, the brakes in the gate. War without a fate. One moment, no.
supporter of the Zeitgeist movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on, not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
Yeah, that's right. We do have a world to save, Harry Case and the Zeitgeist Movement. And as you know, ladies and gentlemen, I've been a big supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. I think the Zeitgeist films are so important. Out of all the intellectual authorities that I cite on this program, Ralph Nader, Noam Chomsky, Tom Hartman, you know, maybe Dr. Reich, Dean Baker, others, Peter Joseph and the Zeitgeist Movement and some of the concepts discussed in the Zeitgeist films really forced me to think the hardest. You know, let me give you some quotes here, and I want to tell you about something I got coming up with. I'm not a Zeitgeist Movement member, and I don't speak for the movement. I speak for myself, and so but I want to tell you about some things, but I just want to give you some quotes here, some concepts from the Zeitgeist Movement that I remember off the top of my head, because this is what I do, folks. Okay, I'm like some things I'm like an almanac here. All right, in one of the Zeitgeist films, Peter Joseph talks about the anti-economy. He brings on a professor who talks about the anti-economy, because an economy is supposed to efficiently and conservatively orient the material for production and distribution of life-supporting goods. I'm going off the top of my memory here, but that's it. Basically, you know, moving goods around efficiently, transporting goods, efficiently making goods and goods that are efficient for the environment. But yet our economy is built on consumption, and efficiency is the absence of waste. And so we have an economy that's built on consumption, the more the better, but we cannot have that in order, somebody in my ear here telling me 60 seconds. You can't have that, you can't efficiently, you know, have an economy without absence of waste when your economy is built on consumption, which requires waste, requires things break down, and us to become consumers and money move around, in an arbitrary game that holds no productive value for society. Check out the Zeitgeist movies. By the way, we're going to be working with Harry Case on a public access show. We'll give you more information about that as it becomes available. This is going to be in New York City, and this is going to be huge, folks. It really is. I've been wanting to do something on television. Harry's been wanting to do public access show for years, and so he's finally found a partner. You can friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/ Bob Carson MMA. Check out the election boycott website at electionboycott.weebly.com. Like the Carson's Corner Facebook page at Carson's Corner 13, facebook.com Carson's Corner 13. And lastly, you can check out my YouTube videos at youtube.com/Bob Carson MMA. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.